digital, you know what I mean? Can you just say hi for a second?
Hello.
You ever done an interview before?
Not that I was aware of.
You might have been recorded, right?
I've been on a couple of documentaries.
Really? For
yeah.
What?
There's a documentary film lab in Madison, and just happened to be by coincidence that several things that I was involved with, they were doing documentaries of.
Like what?
Oh, one of them was building, making of the new Children's Museum in Madison.
Fascinating thing to be involved with.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you said you also do carpentry stuff.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I made the table for this.
Wow.
That's partly how I became aware of it, was Nick and Sarah asked me to make the table and asked if I could find a big, massive piece of ash for the top, which was challenging. But
this brings up a point. Maybe we should just have you introduce yourself and say who you are and what you do, because I don't actually...
Okay, my name is John Lund. I orbit between Madison and Lafarge. I have the farm in Lafarge. It's my legal address, but most of my income work is in Madison. I've been doing carpentry work for people for over 25 years there since I dropped out of grad school. I took a leave of absence, and I'm still gone.
You're still absent. That's funny. And so the other thing that I know about you is that you have this land.
Yeah.
So what's the idea behind that? Did you buy it?
We bought it to farm it and move the family up there, and it never really worked for moving the family up there because of school and activities and so on. So we still have the base in Madison where the kids are raised, and they're off on their own, and we're transitioning as we move to our older age, but the farming has gotten to be nearly impossible because of flooding.
And what's the story there? So you're now 15 years in, you said, on the property?
Or yeah, about that.
Yeah. And so then you started 15 years ago farming corn and...
Oh, we were doing vegetables, mostly storage vegetables. The main cash crop was garlic. And we were doing direct marketing of beef, sharing a herd of cattle with my neighbors, elderly neighbors, and I bought a cow from them, but she wouldn't stay home. She kept jumping the fence, so we just ended up... Eventually, I owned a quarter of the herd, and we shared responsibility for taking care of them. But then they got delinquent and were always breaking down the fence, and I'd be in Madison working on carpentry projects, and it was January and snowing, and an 80-some-year-old couple was out there trying to fix fence and get the cattle back in. Finally, it was just like, they've got to go down the road.
It's funny what makes a cow get delinquent. Like, is that just something that
happens? Well, the grass is always greener on the other side. Even if it's not, really, it is.
Never heard that actually applied to animals. It's like, yeah, I bet they are hungry.
Well, that's where the expression comes from.
Exactly,
I think, yes.
Yeah, but you use it so metaphorically, don't you? So that's interesting. So, like, one of the things we were talking about the other day is, like, that there's this 15-year trajectory. What's changed? Like, is it feel like it's a new... climate regime these days? Are you in
definitely
a different situation?
Definitely.
What's
when we moved up there, our elderly neighbor that I shared the herd with, they thought that since the reserve project was canceled and all that Kickapoo reserve land is pretty much naturalized, that the intensity and frequency of flooding was less. And the first few years, what we were seeing initially was springtime floodings, which is typical. The ground is still frozen. You've got snow. You get a thunderstorm. It rains. The river comes up, and it goes back down. And it didn't harm the garlic because the garlic was dormant. So to be several feet underwater for a day and a half or 2 days, it didn't matter. But then 2007, we had a 100-year flood. 2008, we had a 500-year flood. 2010, we had another flood. They couldn't decide if it was a 100-year or a 500-year flood. The 2008 flood, we thought that we'd never get a flood as big as that again because that was the record flood at that point. And 1978, previously, was the big flood. Typically, historically, there was like a 25 to 35-year period of big floods that were kind of historic. But nothing had ever been at the scale of 1978 up until then. Then it was pretty quiet until 2008. With this monstrous flood. They redrew all the floodplains because they were no longer relevant. But then 2015, we had the first time ever December flood. And then we had historic floods. 100-year, 500-year, who knows what it was, 2016, 2017, 2018, they called the flood a 1,000-year flood. It was 3.5 feet, a little more than 3.5 feet deeper than the 2008 flood at our farm. I had 7.5 feet of water in the barn. I still haven't cleaned it up. Machinery, crankcases and stuff were filled with water. And I've got Lyme disease too. I've got nerve damage. So just trying to do the physical stuff of keeping up with it, I can't keep up. And then it's like, what do you do? Because the hay land is half flooded still this year. There's springs that have sprung up everywhere. The water table is supercharged. There's just water coming out of the ground throughout the valley. What was my loafing shed watering area for the cattle, as water flowing over it, just from water just coming out of the hillside, flowing across it, and it's just squishy, spongy ground. Can't drive the tractor anywhere on it because it just ruts it up and leaves lakes, and what's the point anyway? So it's kind of like, until there's a lull in the kind of rainfalls that we've been having, that ground isn't going to dry out. We've got to rethink what the land is for. And right now the beavers are going crazy building dams because they're triggered by the running water. They can't help themselves. They hear running water, they try to stop it. So it's this ongoing thing of, am I going out and with a hole? And you can have your pond, but don't flood my hayfield, kind of, you know, pull out a chunk of the dam so that some of it will drain and drain back out of the hayfield. Maybe I can salvage it, but it hasn't been possible so far. So yes, there's definite changes.
That's heavy. I mean, it's also just that last comment you said about rethinking what the land is for. Like, and then you went right to the beavers, right? Because they've rethought what the land is for pretty quickly. Like, you know, they...
Well, there used to be trapping pressure on them, too, and the guy that was trapping them died.
Okay.
Like,
really
locally.
Yeah. Ah, well. Yeah.
But he didn't trap... We didn't allow him to trap on our property, but he trapped locally. So it's like, as long as the habitat was suitable somewhere else, they weren't so active on our place.
But what would be another use? Like, so when you say that about like rethinking the land, like what, like, I mean, it's...
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. And I'm physically not capable of busting butt like I had been when I started.
Yeah, it's hard work, isn't it? I used to work on farms. So one of the things that you like have been hearing about this last couple of days, right, are these like ideas of like indigenous land trusts and mm-hmm. different kinds of management strategies, but that's not even the right word, but like caring for the land in mm-hmm. a different way.
Well, one thing what brought me to grad school was ethnobotany, studying indigenous foods. And at the time at UW-Madison, I only found two books of, one was the Ethnobotany of the Menominee from, published around the turn of the last century. And one other kind of paper, old paper, but there really wasn't anything collection there on it. And I kind of abandoned that because who I was supposed to study under when I got there, I found out he was in sabbatical in Africa. And, you know, so I was kind of funneled into natural resource issues. My major was environmental conservation at Boulder.
Well, so you know a lot about this stuff. So what's the first of all, describe ethnobotany. I've never heard that before. I don't know what that
really?
Is.
Really?
Yeah, maybe I'm just naive.
Well, think of the roots. Ethnic, botany.
But the indigenous
it's the plants, you know, the native plants that the natives used for food, medicine, whatever. I was primarily interested in food plants, and especially as, you know, back in the 80s when I was going to college, we anticipated climate change, and our food models were vulnerable, and there was plenty of food all around us that we're not aware even it's food, and what may have potential to be resurrected and began to be used again, reintroduced. That's what I was interested in. I was very interested in the work of Gary Paul Nabtham, I think is the name, Enduring Seeds. He's involved out in New Mexico, Arizona area.
It's a kind of permaculture's crossover.
He wrote this beautiful book that each chapter was about a different food plant that were used by different Native American tribes and told the story about the food plant and the people that kept the seeds going. So,
yeah. I mean, so I guess what I was headed towards, though, is like, is there something, so you know, you have to rethink the nature of the land that you're on, unless there's a big, you know, unless the rainfall changes or mm-hmm. the water table changes.
Yeah, we could use a little drought.
Yeah, right, yeah. It is really wet, by the way. I'm camping all week, so mm-hmm. I'm very aware of this incredible amount of rain. The second question is then, like, do any of these land trust ideas, and everybody's still trying to figure out what they are, I know, mm-hmm. like, it's,
yeah,
are they practical as, like, solutions for someone like you who's, like, a landholder?
Potentially. And so I need to learn more about it. Mm. I need to learn more about it. I asked the presenter that gave the talk at the reserve on land trusts for her PowerPoint, copy of her PowerPoint. She was going to send it without the pictures. She didn't know if those were protected or not. But it was such a dense presentation, it was hard to... I wasn't taking notes, but I don't think I would have effectively taken notes anyway because it was too much in between each kind of outlined item to fill in. So to revisit that and being friends with Nick and Sarah, I'll be able to get more information on that. And I know some Ho-Chunks in the area also that are involved in indigenous foods. So it got me thinking, but what I'm going to do, I don't know. It's like I need to understand a little bit more and talk with more people.
Mm. I mean, it's an interesting case for you particularly, like, you know, having a land that needs to be rethought anyway.
Land that needs to be rethought, land that I need help with.
So, I mean, is this, like, do you ever think of this as, like, something that could spur some kind of, I don't know, that it seems like what we're all, like, when I come to these things as a somewhat of an outsider, for sure, I'm not from mm-hmm. this area, I'm from Southern Ontario originally, and know the reservation dynamics down there in Canada is slightly different, but I always, you know, grew up thinking that everybody was talking about these issues, because obviously there's a lot of just mm-hmm. Sarnia area is a big Ojibwe territory. But then, of course, you go to Europe, you go to anywhere that doesn't have a kind of active indigenous population. In like Chicago, we were just hearing mm-hmm. about, right? That's, like, totally new to me.
Kind of shocking.
Yeah, really, eh? And 65,000 people, which I wouldn't have thought. But and great to see somebody making noise about that. But what is the question, I guess, is, like, how much of your community and around you, like, if you were to get involved in something like an Indigenous Land Trust, is there a conversation amongst your other neighbors? I mean, obviously, Nick and Sarah are pretty into this stuff, but...
Well, Nick and Sarah are definitely the primary neighbors.
But is there a community discussion going on about, you know, Indigenous land use, reclamation, you know, return even, that is positive and...
Not great? That I'm aware of. Mm. There is the Kickapoo Reserve with the Ho-Chunk management of their part of it. And since the Ho-Chunk returned to Wisconsin and have private acreages, you know, a friend of mine is part of the Green Deer Clan. He's got a farm, although it's hardly a farm, but he does have land, and there's other people around that do have land. So there's people that I can talk to, but I don't know of any talk in the area currently that's talking about returning land to the natives.
Which is, like, well, I guess what I mean is more just also that, but it's like, you know, when you come to these sessions for a weekend, mm-hmm. you think, like, oh, everybody's talking about it. It's great, you know, mm-hmm. like all these people are getting together and stuff like that. And then you, after this is over, you know, this is what happens, right? Like, everybody's always like, well, what do we do? Mm-hmm. Or how do we keep this energy going? And, mm-hmm. and so it's always curious to know, like, if the local scene, like, if this happens every weekend or if it's just something that, you know, like Nick and Sarah do this great 3-4 day thing, and then hopefully there's some ties that bind, you know, and then people get together.
Yeah, I think it's planting seeds is the main thing. Yeah. And it's making connections with other people. And it's also exposure that I have. I might meet someone and say, oh, you really should talk to these people. And that's kind of the magic of life, is making connections. And there's always these kind of interconnecting circles. And that's a big part of taking part.
Cool. Thank you very much. I don't want to take too much of your time. It's really...